Okay, so let's just dive in. We're living in this world of, super personalized playlists, TikTok trends.
Algorithms telling you what to listen to next.
Exactly. So when I say the word radio, I mean you probably picture something dusty, a relic.
And that's the whole paradox we're getting into. Because terrestrial radio, I mean, good old AM/FM, still huge. The numbers are kind of stunning.
Like what?
Something like 8 out of 10 Americans aged 12 and up listen in any given week, so it survived. But the real question is, how does a multi-billion-dollar industry run on content it mostly doesn't pay for?
And that's our mission today.
That's the history.
We're going to trace how radio has evolved since, what, 1896 or so? And we're covering the whole spectrum, AM, FM, satellite like SiriusXM, and internet radio.
But the key here, the thing that ties it all together, is compensation. We're really going to be using insights from SoundExchange to figure out why musicians get paid for some things but completely left out of others.
So we'll hit the history, the money, the politics, and even what's coming next with automation.
Yeah, you're going to be amazed by the story of why your local FM station pays Aretha Franklin basically nothing. It's this whole legal and political saga.
It's just wild that it's still such a force. I mean, we know the usage is massive, but it's not totally immune, right? Listenership is down a bit.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
It's definitely waned. I think the data shows it's down about 10% from 2009 to 2022.
So it's changing.
It's changing, not dying. We're seeing a huge shift in how people listen. It's on apps, it's syndicated nationally, and a lot of people are moving to platforms like SiriusXM.
Because they can be more specific.
Exactly. They don't have the same limits as FM, so they can do these incredibly niche stations. You know, a station just for one artist or only 80s movie soundtracks. You just can't get that on traditional AM/FM.
And that history is so important because the laws we have today are basically stuck in the past. Radio's big boom was the 20s and 30s.
And the golden age in the 40s. It was the only way most people heard music.
Which is the key, right?
It is. The whole legal framework was set up before the recording industry, as we know it, even existed.
Which brings us right to that central mystery. When a song plays on AM/FM radio in the US, the artist who performed it gets nothing.
Zero. The recording artists and the labels who paid for the recording get absolutely zero performance royalties.
So, using your example, Aretha Franklin's Respect.
Perfect example. Otis Redding, who wrote the song His Estate Gets Paid, that's for the songwriting. But Aretha, the person who made it an icon, she gets nothing from that broadcast.
Is the argument still about promotion? Or is it just that the broadcasters are too politically powerful to let the law change?
It's really the second one. I mean, this isn't just some weird American loophole. It's a global anomaly. The US is the only industrialized democracy where this happens.
Wow, so everywhere else.
Everywhere else has what's called neighboring rights. It's basically the performance right for the sound recording itself.
So why don't we have that here?
It's a total victim of history and politics.
Right.
When the Copyright Act was revised in 1909, there was no recording industry to speak of, so only the songwriters had a seat at the table.
Okay, that makes sense for back then.
But by the time they tried to revise it again in the 1970s, the broadcasters had organized, the National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB.
Formed in 1920, so they were well established.
Incredibly powerful. They had become this entrenched political lobby, and they just blocked any change to create that performance right for analog radio.
And their fallback is always the promotional excuse, right?
Yeah.
That playing the music is free advertising.
And that argument is just so thin now. I mean, this is a $14 billion business. They are using this content to generate massive revenue.
It's not just a nice little plug for the artist.
Not at all. It's like if you license a photo for an ad campaign, you still have to pay the photographer, even though the campaign promotes them. The promotion benefit doesn't just cancel out the need to pay for intellectual property, especially when the stations are so profitable.
This whole issue of money and access, it has a pretty dark history. Which brings us to payola.
Right back in the mid-20th century, you had music execs literally paying cash under the table to big DJs like Alan Freed and Dick Clark just to get a song on the air.
A huge scandal.
A huge scandal. And while paying an FM station is technically legal today if you announce it as a sponsorship, that lack of transparency has just taken on new forms. Now we have something called inverse payola.
Inverse payola. So the artist is the one paying.
In a way, yes. The artist is pressured to take a financial hit for exposure. The classic example is Spotify's discovery mode.
Where they take a lower royalty rate for a boost in the algorithm.
Precisely. You agree to a 30% cut in your royalty rate, and they promote your song more. It's not illegal, but it shows you the kind of leverage these platforms have, forcing artists to trade income for visibility.
So the industry saw they couldn't crack the analog radio problem, so they just pivoted to digital.
That's exactly what happened. They finally got a win for performers' rights with a law in 1995, the Digital Performance Right and Sound Recordings Act.
The digital pivot.
The digital pivot. And that's really why SoundExchange exists today.
To handle that digital money.
Correct. SoundExchange, in its current form since about 2003, collects and distributes digital performance royalties. But, and this is crucial, we only focus on non-interactive streaming.
Okay, let's break that down. Non-interactive, what does that mean?
It means you can't pick the specific song you want to hear. Think of it like a radio station. SiriusXM, Pandora, and iHeart station streaming online.
You don't control the playlist.
You don't. No. And because of that, those services don't have to go and negotiate a license for every single song with every single artist. They just pay a set rate to SoundExchange.
And that's working. You said it's over $1 billion a year now.
Mm-hmm.
What's the biggest hurdle in getting that money out?
Oh, the complexity is just enormous. We're collecting from all these digital services plus international money. Like when a U.S. artist gets played on the radio in the U.K., where they do pay, the biggest challenge day to day is data integrity. We call it friction.
Friction?
Yeah. Misspelled names, missing writer information, bad track data. Every little error slows down the process of getting the right person paid. We're always fighting that friction.
It's so interesting that Congress was fine legislating this for digital in the 90s, but they wouldn't touch analog FM.
It all came down to the justification. In the 90s, everyone saw this huge, scary threat of digital piracy.
A whole Napster thing.
Exactly. The ability to make millions of perfect copies at the push of a button. That sense of urgency gave them the political cover to create a new right for digital, something they could never do against the old school FM lobby.
And all of this has completely changed radio's place in the culture. It feels like radio is now a follower, not a leader.
That's a perfect way to put it. The hits break somewhere else first. TikTok, streaming, SiriusXM, and then FM radio looks at the data and jumps on board.
It's the last stop for a song to become truly everywhere.
The final destination for ubiquity, yeah. And that shift is tied directly to consolidation, which all goes back to the 1996 telecommunications bill.
The one that lifted the ownership caps.
It blew them away. It let these huge corporations buy up hundreds, sometimes thousands, of local stations. And that was the death of the local DJ.
The death of local flavor.
Completely. Suddenly, the programming wasn't coming from a DJ in Des Moines who knew their community. It was coming from a corporate office in New York.
Mm.
You lose all that spontaneity, that willingness to take a risk on something new.
And you just get the same top 10 songs over and over. It's safer. It's data-driven. I've even heard they cut out the DJ announcing the songs just to squeeze in more ads.
Oh, they absolutely do. Every single second is a potential ad spot. It's why they still love shorter songs. There's this legendary story about a hit song that was 4 minutes and 10 seconds.
Uh-huh.
And the label put 3 minutes and 70 seconds on the liner notes, just trying to sneak it past the programmers. They're always looking for that edge.
And the logical endpoint of all that efficiency is just pure automation. AI.
That's the next frontier and the biggest threat. We've already seen it. A rock station in Iowa used an AI personality, DJ Tori, to run their overnight shift.
Wow.
It's the next logical step. If you're already centralizing the playlists, why pay a person when an AI can do it for cheaper? It's why there's this big push in Congress for the bipartisan No Fakes Act.
To protect a person's name, image, voice.
Their likeness, their voice, exactly. It's about protecting against AI mimicry and deepfakes. It recognizes that a human voice is a form of intellectual property.
And on the corporate side, iHeart just made a big deal about their guaranteed human policy.
Right. They planted a flag, a hard stance against AI songs, AI hosts, AI podcasts.
Which is great, but how do you even police that?
That's the billion-dollar question. Detection is incredibly difficult. One study said 97% of people can't tell the difference between AI-made music and human-made music.
It's terrifying.
It is. And it's why it's so important that AI companies are required to, you know, label or embed watermarks in their content. Otherwise, the data integrity problem, the friction we're already fighting, just explodes.
So what does SoundExchange do right now if a song comes in that might be 100% AI?
We're being very cautious. Right now, the U.S. Copyright Office says purely AI-generated work isn't copyrightable. So we generally won't pay out royalties on a song we suspect is 100% AI. We just hold the money and wait for more clarity. We can't distribute funds for something that might not even be protectable property.
Which brings this whole conversation right back around to the big legislative fight that's still happening. The American Music Fairness Act, the AMFA.
This is the one. This is the fight to finally fix that legacy problem. It's supported by Sound Exchange, the indie labels, the unions, and it would finally make terrestrial FM radio pay a performance royalty, just like everybody else.
But the broadcasters will say it'll kill local radio.
They will, and the bill is ready for that. That's the most important part of the AMFA. It's tiered to protect the small guys.
How so?
A small mom-and-pop station, one making up to $1.5 million a year, would only pay a tiny royalty, like $500 a year for commercial stations. Nonprofits and college radio would pay even less, maybe $10 a year.
So the focus is really on the big corporate giants.
The financial burden is aimed squarely at the multi-billion dollar conglomerates that own hundreds of stations. It's not about hurting the community station, and the momentum for this is real.
I saw that letter from all those artists.
Over 300 A-list artists, and you had Gene Simmons from KISS testifying in the Senate. For someone like him, it's not about his own bank account. It's about making sure the next generation of artists can actually build a career.
So to wrap this all up then.
I mean, to summarize, radio is still this huge, ubiquitous platform, but it's incredibly consolidated. And its whole payment system is just this outdated political artifact where lobbying power has won out over property rights for decades.
So now you know. You know why artists get a check from SiriusXM, but nothing from your local FM station. You get the history of payola, the difference between interactive and non-interactive, and the fight for the AMFA.
And as you think about this huge gap between the U.S. and basically the rest of the world, here's a final thought to chew on. In the United States, when we have these kinds of disputes, they usually fall to the Department of Justice. Their main focus is antitrust, it's commerce, it's competition.
Right.
But in a lot of European countries, they have a minister of culture, a cabinet-level job to oversee the creative industries. So what does it say when our system treats these fundamentally cultural issues primarily as business competition problems? It tells you something about where we place the value on the art itself or on the business of distributing it. Something to think about the next time you hear a song and wonder who's actually making money.